Our topic may seem a bit unusual, the yoga of money. Generally, when we think of yoga, we think of physical postures for increasing flexibility, for helping us to lose weight, and all those good things. It's a health thing. Actually, though, when we look at the classical yoga texts of ancient India, we find that yoga has a far extensive scope. In fact, the very word yoga means connection, to link. If you look at life in terms of network of connections, we might get some new perspectives. The yoga of money means let's look at how we're connected to money in terms of our investment of core assets of the self. Money brings many conflicting emotions. Some people embrace it heartily as the life force itself. Most of you have heard the expression, well, money can't buy everything. But there's another part to that. What it can't buy, it can rent. So, you have three camps I've found in my travels around the world, whether in first world countries or developing nations. You have three camps of reactionaries to money. The first camp, embrace it. It's money is the honey essence of life. The second camp, our family never thinks about money. Money issues don't matter at all in our life. Focus on other things. Many people call this the denial camp. Then the third camp is, no. Sometimes money is exhilarating and sometimes it's tragic. It depends on what's going on in the world. Rather than feverishly embrace money or deny our relationship with it or be ambivalent about it, let's look at it. Let's examine it. It's such an important factor in life. Of course, many of you here are involved with measuring that life blood, monitoring its flow. If we can focus upon our relationship with money, we'll get a good idea of how our heart is invested. And I think it's very important that we consider our heart energies and how they're invested, not be in a state of denial about that. If you just look at the flow of money in your life, you'll see, to a great extent, where your life is heading, what your life is and what involves your life. We're going to move beyond the personal interaction with money to discuss accounting systems, their assumptions, buried conceptions. But first, I'd like to have you think deeply about how much a role money plays in our individual life before we move to the wider social setting. We're going to be discussing some things that are new and some things that are very, very old. I'm happy to hear that the CMA organization fosters whole brain thinking in terms of business strategies, business solutions, the left brain and the right brain, the logical, analytical side, as well as the imaginative, intuitive, inspirational side. Keeping that in mind, I'd like to just have a short preface to the main body of our discussion. Mantra meditation, this timeless spiritual technology, is very effective for stimulating our dormant spiritual capacities and freeing the mind from rigid conditioned patterns. I wondered whether to do this or not. But indeed, since our gathering at the Rothman School of Business and Management, where indeed we had a very short spell of mantra meditation, I observed the response amongst the erudite participants, I became engladdened and decided, indeed, such a short exercise would be very appropriate for stimulating our spiritually creative energies. In our work for the Institute for Sustainable Society in New Zealand, which includes advanced degree holders in environmental science, of course, as well as advanced degree holders in accounting, artificial intelligence, and as I said, it's an interdisciplinary approach. We've identified accounting as an extraordinarily significant activity, far beyond what the average educated person understands. Whatever values that accountants hold very dearly, to a great extent, you'll see those values reflected in society, how society operates, where society is headed. In the last decade or so, we've seen the globalization of accounting standards. The majority of developed nations follow the International Financial Reporting Standards, and you know, Canada is set to adopt those standards in 2011. Purely from a fiscal point of view, as seen in the neoclassic way, as seen in the conventional way, this certainly seems to be a completely good idea. Why not? A worldwide set of accounting standards. It'll make financial information more utilizable for international activity. It'll make life easier for companies in terms of access to capital, investment opportunities. So once again, from the conventional point of view, the neoclassical economic point of view, this adoption of international reporting standards has been greeted as a good thing. It'll improve economic growth and opportunity. However, in recent decades, and especially now in the past 2 years due to the global economic situation, there's been a growing body of interdisciplinary research in the field of accounting, which reflects what's happened in economics. Many of you may know how in the past 10 years, suddenly you have this huge field of ecological economics and behavioral economics. This has impacted upon accounting. And you'll find accounting indeed has become interdisciplinary as more and more educated persons understand that accountants affect society more than what has been suspected in the past. Looking at current social and environmental situations, some academics have suggested that mainstream accounting, classical accounting, has left out many crucial factors. Perhaps most famous is the factor of the effect of a corporation on its surrounding environment. We're going to discuss that today, but we're going to go deeper. In other words, we want to go beyond what is ordinarily known as ecology or environmentalism and try to get to the root cause of very critical situation in the history of human existence. I was listening to the dean of the Yale School of Environment, which is the oldest environmental school in North America, Dr. James Speth, former head of UN Development, and called by Time Magazine as the ultimate insider. He's back at Yale now as dean, and he very convincingly made that if we want to leave a ruined world for our children and grandchildren, all we have to do now is keep everything the same. Just keep the level of environmental correction the same, keep the population the same, keep the world economy at the same level, and you'll have a ruined earth the time your children and grandchildren see the end of this century. Of course, population is not going to stay the same. And the impact of the world economy on the environment is not going to stay the same. Those two things are going up. What our response as human beings to the extraordinary environmental crisis is, well, that remains to be seen. I spoke about these points in detail Friday of last week, University of Toronto. I'm going to because our time is short. Stick to mainly the accounting focus. I just wanted to give you some background, briefly, why a growing field of academics suggested there's a problem with mainstream accounting, and there's a great opportunity. There's an old Chinese proverb, may you live in interesting times. Congratulations. We're going to be considering some of this new research, and we'll also be exploring the knowledge of the ancient yoga texts of India, particularly the Krishna texts. We're going to tap into them for knowledge about the ultimate connection. In 2007, I spoke about spiritual economics, the Rotman School of Business and Management, and I explained some aspects of how an economy can be spiritualized by basing an economy not on getting, but giving. Giving what? We'll talk about that later. I concluded at that suggestions as to how someone can go to their workplace motivated by, I'm going in order to be able to give the tools of spiritual enlightenment to society as a whole. But first, that may seem a bit impractical, perhaps some of you are thinking, what is this spirit? But later in our talk, I'm going to ground that spiritual talk in the science of consciousness, the greatest mystery which Western science has not solved, and in fact, many scientists will honestly say we don't think we'll ever solve. What is consciousness? Where did it come from? What are the needs of consciousness? We're going to relate that to accounting. When we look at the Krishna texts of ancient India, such as Bhagavad Gita, many of you are familiar with, revered as greatest literatures in the world, and certainly one of its preeminent spiritual texts. When we look at the models given in the Krishna texts, we find that the self in Sanskrit, Atma, refers to three dimensions of being. The body of matter, the chemical body you can call it, the psychological self, the workings of the mind, and then the unit of consciousness, which cannot be analyzed materially. Keep that in the back of your mind, please, as we move forward into the topic of spiritual accounting. Remembering that because accounting is so influential in the allocation of the lifeblood, the money, and other resources, therefore, how accountants account and what they account for has an enormous impact in society. Let's open up an introductory accounting textbook. I know almost everyone here is far beyond that, but let's just refresh ourselves. You'll likely find a statement like this. Accounting is intended to provide interested parties with the information that will enable them to make informed economic decisions. Economic decisions are obviously made on the basis of accounting data. Therefore, again, you see the huge role that accountants play. Everyone knows how in the corporate world, the first things a financial analyst goes for are the financial statements. Any bank, any lending agency, they'll all go for that. Accountants and their judgments have an extraordinary influence on where enormous amounts of money and human energy are placed. Remember, the yoga of money. We're not simply talking about money as if it exists out of relationship with human beings. Where the money goes, that's where the heart is. So accountants, in a widened sense, are tracking human intentions and heartfelt hopes and fears. Obviously then, accounting is not just a dull mathematical application. And therefore, accounting should be of great concern to everyone. If any of you are familiar with in literature, the latest conceptions, you'll find the work of Dr. Ruth Hines very influential. She'll clearly explain how accounting and its data have tremendous influence over what society produces, what the members of society consume, And then, as a consequence, the level of consciousness of the people. Dr. Ruth Hines puts it this way. If in our system of accounting, all we value are the materialistic aspects of the universe, then that conception creates a society that is only concerned with such materialistic aspects. On Friday, here at the university, I quoted someone who's arguably the most famous scientist in the world, Stephen Hawking. He gave his verdict. Just face it. The human race is simply a chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. Some people will say, that's right, that's all it is. Others intuitively reject that, even though they don't have the knowledge to base their intuition upon. There's just something more to me in my life than if I have a family, I'll go home to, my wife or husband's come. And yes, we can readily see that Stephen Hawking's pronouncement has some dire consequences. Let's look at accounting with that same analytical eye. First, we'll consider the environment. If you want to have an environmentally sustainable society, then it's very important that you consider the values that inform our accounting system, especially now that we're on the verge of a global financial reporting standard. Again, whatever values the accounting system holds dear will to a large extent decide what our society is like and what the future of the environment is. When we look at the Krishna texts of ancient India, such as Bhagavad Gita, we see a concern with achieving maximum human potential for all aspects of the self, and recognizing the most important aspect of the self is the conscious self. Can consciousness be reduced to something material? We'll discuss more of that later. Let's look at the theory behind mainstream accounting. You could say mainstream before the start of this century. There is a new school of accounting developing quite rapidly, which wants to take into account all aspects of human experience, and depending on how deep your accounting is, we've heard of deep ecology, deep economics, now we're getting deep accounting. Depending on how deep your penetration is, you can get all the way to the level of consciousness and its needs. In other words, the spiritual dimension of accounting. In neoclassical economics, we all know about the invisible hand, which indeed, according to some person's analysis, based on what's happening in the past 2 years in financial markets, indeed the invisible hand of the marketplace has become very invisible. You might be surprised to know that Adam Smith, who first coined this term in his famous text, he used it only three times. But mentioning it three times was enough since then that the term has become almost a religious tenet. The theory assumes that there's a free market and every individual in that free market acts for his or her own self-interest, and based on pursuing individual self-interest, the greater good for society is achieved. Briefly mention Adam Smith's famous quote. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own self-interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages. The assumption, of course, in so many words, is that greed will drive persons to beneficial behavior. Unfortunately, what we're seeing today, the world has changed greatly under Adam Smith, is that greed will drive actors to greed. In neoclassical economics, there's the notion that as the economy grows, it floats all the boats. In a rising tide, all the boats go up. Basically, that means that the spending of the wealthy ensures that all peoples are financially better off. and that will happen dynamically and automatically. Regardless of where you are on the political spectrum, left, right, center, the scientific facts in the past decades don't bear that out. Nevertheless, neoclassical economic theory assumes that when everyone becomes financially better off, they're also better off in every other aspect of their life. Why is that assumption there? That assumption is there because of another assumption. Things that can satisfy us are traded on the market. So therefore, if you act on accounting information for your own self-interest, you'll improve the welfare of all, or at least most members of society, because you're dealing with things that can satisfy. Things that can satisfy are dealt with in the marketplace. Traditionally, it's thought that if accounting focuses almost exclusively on the question of how much profit was made for the shareholders, accounting is doing its best to help allocate resources to where they can be utilized best. There's no need to have concern for social or environmental costs, because these will be corrected by the market. These days, that theory is under great attack, not simply in economics because of research and data from the past 50 years, but also in accounting. Environmental accountants will say there's no direct evidence to support the claim that economic growth leads to the improvement of social and environmental welfare. If we use a system that assumes that, our decision-making will result in the misallocation of resources, meaning the destruction of the environment. Again, whether you put yourself on the left or the right of the political spectrum, we're talking about research data, the effects of the economy in terms of division of wealth and impact on the environment. Let's look at the conventional solutions of social and environmental accounting. Just to have social and environmental accounting in of itself is the cutting edge. But we're going to jump beyond the cutting edge. But first, let's give credit to the cutting edge because it's doing some good things. Environmentally minded academics raise the point. How can we make corporations report environmentally? If they did so, then decisions would be based on more honest accounting data. Let's look at the work of probably the most influential academic in the environmental accounting discipline, Professor Rob Gray of the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. He's the director for the Center for Social and Environmental Accounting Research. He and his associates have made enormous contributions in the field of environmental accounting. In some of his recent work, he has investigated whether the voluntary environmental accounting by large corporations actually helps to create a culture of sustainability. Bear in mind, Rob Gray is a very accomplished academic, and he has a lot more freedom of speech than others in the field might. His credentials, his years of service to the community of environmentalists, his academic prestige allows him to be regarded as a significant authority. So he's not in danger of losing his funding when he severely questions the fundamental principles on which the current accounting system is based. He states that unless we change the current notions of what are regarded as value and wealth, we'll not be able to affect any significant change in the sustainability of the current economic environment. This is a very important point. Change our notions of what are regarded as value and wealth. Accountants deal with value and wealth. If we're going to take creative accounting to its positive end, then indeed, it seems obvious we should take Rob Gray very seriously. Let's question and change the current notions of what's regarded as value and wealth. He says, the very purpose of financial reporting is to show how much richer people will be by receiving a result of a particular economic activity, while ignoring how that surplus has been calculated. So here we're getting to the root. How that surplus has been calculated. Does that calculation include effects on health, effects on mental health, effects on the environment? Indeed, effects on what could be said to be prime needs of consciousness. Mr. Gray is not just taking pot shots and throwing bombs. He's also suggesting alternative models that can be used in place of the current system. Obviously, he's going to assert that we need something more than just a voluntary environmental reporting. So from this school of environmental accountants, you'll see models like SAMS, the sustainability assessment models, and perhaps more famous, the ecological footprint model. In these models, the environmental impact of a corporation or a nation is measured against some firm criteria. In other words, not just voluntary disclosure. Accountants deal with firm criteria. So the School of Environmental Accountants say, let's have indeed some firm criteria to evaluate the full impacts as they see it, of corporate decisions, governmental decisions. We'll just take a brief look at the ecological footprint model. It's a measure of human demand on the Earth's ecosystem. The ecological footprint model represents the amount of biologically productive land and sea needed to regenerate the resources of a human population after consumption, of course. That's one thing. The other thing is how much land and sea area is needed to absorb and render harmless all the waste that comes from the production and consumption in a human population. By this kind of accounting, it's possible to estimate how much of the Earth, or how many planet Earths, that's what we have to talk about now, it would take to support humanity if everyone lived a given lifestyle. Perhaps you're aware of some statistics. If everyone in China owned cars as Americans do, if everyone in China ate the same diet as North Americans do, what will happen when this new cheapest car hits the streets in India? Right now in Mumbai, 150 new cars every day enter the roads. In Delhi, 250 new cars enter the roads. This is before the advent of the Nano, the super cheap car. All that will have an environmental impact. How many Earths will it take to sustain our lifestyle? Right now, the calculation is 1.3. We're far beyond what this planet Earth can accommodate in terms of our economic presence. We need 1.3 Earths as of 2004. Very soon it's expected that we'll need double Earths, two Earths, to handle the impact of human society. Obviously, we're going to give credit to this fascinating model of accounting. It's a very good idea. But we want to go further. Certainly, if we can improve the sustainability of corporations, a lot of their current practices will be called to question. Still, although this ecological footprint model is indeed quite conducive for measuring environmental impact, accounting for what happens to the environment, we want to go further. We want to deal with the spiritual accounting methods given in the Krishna texts of India. This knowledge has been passed over because, well, it's not Western. Therefore, even the cutting-edge schools of ecological accounting and economics rarely consider the spiritual perspectives coming from the East, particularly these Krishna texts. We discussed already how, according to those texts, the self has three dimensions. physical, mental, as well as spiritual. Spiritual in terms of consciousness, that science cannot adequately explain what is consciousness, gives you an intuition that consciousness could be pointing to a non-material reality. In my travels on every continent of the world, I discussed with quite a few scientists, and they'll all agree with this analysis. Basically, they fall into three camps. Those who think consciousness is material, it emanates from neural activity in the brains, there's no doubt about it, even though there's no proof for it. And in the future, the proof will come. So that's one group. Very religious, I must add. Very religious in that. And they're holding to that belief. The second group feels that consciousness is beyond human comprehension. It'll always be that way. Just permanently outside the range of our scientific paradigm. And the third group says, we don't know. Could be one way, it could be the other. The Krishna texts of ancient India focus on this mystery of consciousness and say it must be accounted for. In other words, let's not just take into account the environment in terms of nature as we know it. Let's also look at our consciousness and how our consciousness is affected by what's around us. What are the needs and wants of consciousness? With all due credit to the ecological footprint model or other similar cutting-edge models in terms of their accounting for the environment, I would like to present that they fall short from the Krishna perspective in terms of how to fully satisfy the self on all levels. This is a very important point, because when people are unsatisfied in some way, then, for sure, they'll turn to consumption patterns and lifestyle choices that are unsustainable. They're feeling a sense of incompleteness, lacking of a satisfying connection. The unit of consciousness, known in Sanskrit as the Atma, the spiritual self, is seeking completeness in matter, products and items of matter. Seeking completeness and fulfillment in material affairs. And because that can never satisfy the unit of spiritual consciousness, known as the Atma, our real self, therefore we're constantly struggling for more and more, and even when we get what we think we want, we're not satisfied. This is all because of a lack of ultimate connection. In our three aspects of the self, the physical, the mental, and the consciousness, or you can say the soul, but to avoid unnecessary Western religious overtones, I use the unit of consciousness, or the Sanskrit word, Atma. Of those three, obviously, our consciousness is most important. It's the permanent part of the self. If we're going to have ethics in accounting, and I very happily noted in your mission statement for the CMA and your statement of ethics, that it is said that the certified management accountant should have responsibility for the people's needs and fidelity to the people's needs. Very good. The question, however, is who are the people and what are their needs? Accounting has to deal with that if it's going to grasp the full picture. We're talking about an enlightened society, obviously, when accounting will go even beyond environmentalism, which is considered currently the cutting edge. When accounting goes beyond even ecological measuring and tracking ecological impact and goes to what is the self and the needs of the self, then indeed you have an enlightened society. Because accountants track what is most important in a materialistic society. The flow of money, the lifeblood, is most important. Yes, we're proposing a more enlightened society. But again, to quote Dr. James Speth, the Dean of the Yale School of Environment, right now is the time for thinking outside the box. The environmental situation, the crisis, has become so bad that If you just want to go on thinking the same way, that's impractical. The most practical thing right now, he says, is jump out of the box and consider completely different ways of looking at things. Let's just briefly look at our material aspects. The cells of the body are constantly changing. The activities of the mind are constantly changing. Your psychology as a child is different than your psychology as a teenager or an adult. Although the body and mind are always in a state of flux, the perceiver, the core identity of the perceiver remains the same. This is the famous analysis that Lord Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita, that you change bodies and minds like you change clothes, but the wearer of those clothes remains the same. So similarly, the unit of spiritual consciousness known as the Atma changes bodies, changes mindsets, but that core basic identity, the Atma, the unit of spiritual consciousness, remains the same. If we have an accounting system that neglects to account for the needs of the conscious aspect of the self, the Atma, then no matter how progressive it may be, that system may be, in caring for the environment and society, it's overlooking so much untapped human potential. In other words, just as there are physical needs of the body, psychological needs of the mind, so also there are needs of the conscious aspect. Or, to be more precise than saying aspect, the real core, which is consciousness, and the other things, the body and mind, are aspects. Since the consciousness is more permanent than the body and mind, obviously it needs a source of pleasure that's also permanent. What happens when we try to experience happiness through our senses and our mind? Can't be satisfied. The senses and the mind are temporary, and that particular kind of material happiness that the temporary mind and senses perceive, it's flickering and will not satisfy the core you. The past 10 years have seen the prevalence of the psychology of happiness. That science has spawned Nobel Prize-winning economists who have combined psychology and economics. Their research convincingly shows that as income increases beyond a basic middle-class standard, happiness does not increase. The jury's no longer out on that point. Again and again, so much research shows that although the GDP of so many nations has tripled, even quintupled since 1950, there's been no increase in measured happiness. In fact, in some places like the USA, it's gone down, even before the economic troubles of the past year and a half or so. Our consciousness, our spiritual self, the consciousness, requires a source of happiness that's more permanent than the type available currently in the marketplace. We're not talking about religious belief here. We're talking about the availability of techniques for the spiritual experience of our conscious self. And then we'll go beyond that, because we're not the everything. Materially, you can't say you're the everything. Your body is limited. Your mind is limited. Even spiritually, you cannot say you're the everything. You're part of the greater reality. What is the nature of that greater reality? Real yoga means to make that ultimate connection between the individual tiny particle of consciousness, that is us, and the supreme consciousness. When we try to experience happiness in relation to the mind and senses, in other words, the body, we find what in economics you call the law of diminishing marginal returns, and in the new psychology of happiness, new meaning past 10 years, you'll find this process known as hedonic adaptation. You get something that you hanker for so much, you get that desired consumer item, ever, any kind of material item, you get it, and it's so fresh and exhilarating at first, and very quickly you suffer adaptation. The luster is lost, the thrill is gone. instead of thinking there's something basically wrong with this whole process of acquisition and trying to fulfill my inner needs by turning upon the environment and squeezing something from it. Instead of doing that, why don't I seek to make another kind of connection? In other words, if we can provide the conscious self with its needs, then someone is actually satisfied and they don't have to live in an unsustainable fashion. In this way, we see that the science of yoga advocating the connection between the tiny consciousness and the supreme consciousness is extraordinarily important. Now we're discussing the highest form of sustainable accountability. Let's account for the needs of the conscious self. It's not enough that we are simply held accountable for the impact on the environment. We also need to be held accountable for the needs of the conscious self. Let's go back to conventional problems, the problems of human and social existence as ordinarily seen. A big hurdle that environmental academics have to try to jump across is the notion that the moral obligation of the managers of a business to maximize profits of the shareholders has to be held supreme. The shareholders' money should not be spent in some whimsical way for the benefit of society or the environment. Obviously, that would mean no spending for enlightenment or understanding consciousness and its needs. Many of you know that Milton Friedman has, especially in the past, been considered the spokesperson for the current economic paradigm. He's asserted that the corporate manager is an employee of the shareholders and therefore has the moral responsibility to act in their interest. He claims that the social responsibility of the corporation is to increase its profits solely for the shareholders. And if any other social interest would be adopted, that would be immorality, immorally spending someone else's money. The ecological economists had their answer to that. They say, look, let's face the truth. Frankly, squarely, we have not inherited this earth from our parents. We have borrowed it from our children. If we live in such a way that we destroy the earth by the time our children and grandchildren come of age, we've done the greatest immorality. This is a completely different way of looking at things. We have not inherited the earth from previous generations. We've borrowed it from the future. Right now, the extinction rate of species is 1,000 times what is normal. There's never been anything like this in known human history since 65 million years ago when the dinosaurs became extinct. If things go on like this, all biologists have the general consensus that if things go on like this, by the end of this century, your children and grandchildren will see half of all species either gone or on their way out. So once again, please think about this point. We have not inherited the earth from our parents. We've borrowed the earth from our children. Still, I want to go deeper. The valuable gift of developed consciousness that nature has given you in the form of a human body. In the Krishna texts of ancient India, this human form of life is stressed as the vehicle for solving all the big questions, who we are and how we should live individually and as a society, how to make the ultimate connection. If we waste that human form of life on simply sophisticated affairs that the animal kingdom does very proficiently, then this is a great disaster. If any of you have studied ant colonies, beehives, you know the extraordinary sophistication in terms of food gathering, in terms of division of labor, in terms of cooperation. Human beings can't compete with that. But human beings have the developed consciousness to understand what is the self, what is the supreme self, and the connection between the two. If a corporate manager has no concern in terms of accounting for the social and environmental impact that the corporation causes, how can this be in society's best interest? Friedman will argue that it's not within the scope of the resource providing manager to spend the shareholders' money on the environment because the manager's not an environmental scientist. That's not his field of expertise. The corporate executive is an entrepreneur and a manager, but he's not an environmentalist, the argument goes, and therefore she's not qualified to try and do some good for the environment. Leave that to the government. This is easy to say until, of course, we take into account the obvious point that multinational corporations are bigger than governments. Obviously, the needs of the environment are universal to both the corporate manager and the shareholder and everyone else. We can't divorce ourselves from that reality. But not only are the needs of the environment universal to everyone, also the needs of the conscious self are universal to everyone. Therefore, if the corporate managers make some endeavor to improve the availability of the technology for self-realization, enlightenment, consciousness enhancement, or as we say, Krishna consciousness, then this is beneficial for everyone. In other words, why this arbitrary narrow view that Mr. Friedman, and of course his words have enormous effect, why such a narrow view? Why arbitrarily do we focus on such a narrow view and then we have to account for all the fallout? Considering again the topic of the ultimate connection, in the famous spiritual text Bhagavad Gita, Krishna explains that someone who is in an advanced state of consciousness is always pleasurable, joyful, because they don't identify with the body and mind as the self. They actually are aware of their identity as a unit of pure spiritual consciousness. Because of being aware of their real identity, such persons don't have any hankerings, certainly no consumerist hankerings, no material passionate longings, because those things pertain to the body and mind. So obviously, if someone is situated in that state of consciousness in which they are aware of their consciousness, spiritual identity, they won't act in such a way as to have inexhaustible needs which such dangerous consequences. So please, three things Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita. The joyfulness and steady state of pleasure that comes from someone who understands their spiritual identity. The lack of hankering, longing, passionately desiring for something outside of the self to fulfill the self. And then seeing all living entities as equal, regardless of their bodily forms. Seeing that in every life form, there is consciousness, although not as developed as in the human body. Once you have those three entry qualifications, then you can proceed to the yoga of the ultimate connection. But those three entrance requirements are necessary. That yoga of ultimate connection, in Sanskrit, is known as bhakti, the connection through pure love and devotion, and in English is known as Krishna consciousness. I'm suggesting that we need some spiritualized accounting. Otherwise, when the self is not held accountable in any way to the Supreme Self, you give power of attorney to your mind and senses and become accountable to them. And then we have economics as a science of how to allocate resources to meet the unlimited amount of needs and wants of a person who's out of touch with himself, herself, out of touch with the real needs of the self. So please bear that in mind. You do without spiritual technology of the ultimate connection, being held accountable to the ultimate consciousness, and then you have to surrender to the demands of the body of matter, the mind of matter, and their insatiable demands. Their demands are insatiable. The psychology of happiness has shown that any attempt for stimulating the body, stimulating the mind, is always diminishing. And our senses don't give us any holiday. Not that, all right, I've served my senses and their demands so laboriously for decades now, surely they'll give me relief. They'll grant me a holiday. Okay, you don't have to worry about the demands of your senses. Never happens. There's no holiday. Insatiable. If we base our economy on the insatiable artificial needs and wants, there's going to be no hope for the Earth. We've already run out of one planet. We're on 1.3 planets. In a few decades, expected we'll need two planet Earths. I hope now that you can see that the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, as spoken by Lord Krishna, is intended as something to base a spiritually orientated society upon. Nevertheless, it has implications for our personal lifestyle as well. In conclusion, allow me to present that ultimate remedies don't lie in stricter forms of environmental accounting, although these are certainly a step in the right direction to increase the scope of accounting. Instead, we need to broaden the idea of the self and what the self needs in order to be completely satisfied. We need to broaden our conception of what complete satisfaction actually is. These recommendations have been made in the ancient Krishna texts thousands of years ago. Yet there are groups of researchers now who are saying similar things. Let's go down under to RMIT, Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology in Melbourne, Australia. That's the Australian equivalent of MIT. We'll look at the research of Philomena Leung and Barry Cooper. They call that we raise consciousness from simply the concern with the body and mind to something higher. They're doing their research in the wake of several well-known accounting scandals and corporate collapses, World.com, Enron. These two researchers have observed that the typical response of governments and professional bodies to corporate greed has been to introduce more regulations and professional codes. And it's generally thought the more rules and regulations you have, the more such occurrences will not happen. This is of the same mentality as the ecological footprint model. In other words, it doesn't go deeper. Land and Cooper explained that to implement more rules and reporting standards will only scratch the surface of problems, and the problems go much deeper. They suggest that the type of creative accounting, used the wrong way, that took place in large corporate scandals like Enron is a sign of the underlying level of materialism that has saturated Western societies. So here you have accounting researchers who are focusing on the whole conception of accounting, and they're fingering the culprit to be rampant materialism. In other words, uncontrolled senses and uncontrolled mind. So what Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita is indeed now being verified by contemporary research. I find that quite interesting. These two researchers in accounting philosophy, shall we call it, have said that unless you treat the cause of the disease, this rampant materialism, uncontrolled senses, then the symptoms will only become manifest in another way, shape, or form. You regulate it here, you put codes there, but the same problem pops up another way. It's like trying to grease down the tail of a dog. I don't know if you ever tried that. You have a pet dog and the tail is always wagging high in the air. You get some grease and try to make the tail stay down. No, it'll pop up again. So similarly, rules and regulations, social protocols to avoid disasters like World.com and Enron, don't get at the underlying problem. Underneath it all is a problem of consciousness. What are the needs of consciousness? And how we mistakenly strive to satisfy the needs of the body and mind, which are artificial, And therefore, we get caught in this spiral of nonstop hedonic adaptation. I want this. Oh, now I'm tired of it. I want something else. As you know, this even affects relationships. These days, it's quite popular to treat relationships like consumer goods. You acquire them, you get tired of them, on to the next version. If we're dealing with the environment, we can apply more rules and regulations. If we're dealing with corporate scandals, we can apply more rules and regulations to stop the creative accounting. But have we dealt with the underlying monster? In other words, unless we can reduce the desire for excessive consumption, we haven't dealt with the underlying problem. But now things get scary to the neoclassical economic mindset. Reduced desires for consumption. What will society be about? What will we do? How will we work? How will we live? How will we survive? We need knowledge, indeed, of a lifestyle of controlling the mind and senses by filling our topmost desires. This point is very lucidly explained by Krishna in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna explains that a yogi may try to rigidly control the senses by refraining from this, refraining from that. But the yogi will fail. The only way the yogi will succeed in controlling the lower impulses is by getting a higher taste of pleasure. In other words, the higher taste does away with the lower taste. This is self-interest in a much higher way than what Adam Smith had in mind. Self-interest in the spiritual dimension. If I can taste a higher pleasure than what rampant materialism can offer, then I'll give up. I'll slacken my grip on that rampant materialism. Otherwise, if you just say no, it's not going to work. A rule here, a protocol there, somewhere or other, human beings will get around it because they have this insatiable thirst for connecting with something. But what they're connecting with is not satisfying them. Therefore, they go on and on trying to deal with this fire of desire. Real yoga means how to aim your desire at the ultimate source rather than spread your desires amongst temporary pursuits. Unfortunately, it's highly typical of Western societies to just treat the symptoms of a disease rather than the underlying cause. But once again, if we can reduce the desires for excessive consumption in a positive way, then we may have a chance how to live in this world in a sustainable way. Friday, when I was speaking here at the university, I described that when economic development means lust on an organized scale. Everyone knows what individual lust is like, at least in some forms. Now just imagine that lust on a mass scale, an organized scale. How to deal with that fire in a way that everyone can benefit, that the environment can benefit. When accountants will take that into account, you'll indeed see an enlightened society because accountants actually have their fingers on what are the most important juices flowing through this system of society. The yoga texts will tell you that material desires are insatiable, just like fuel on fire creates an insatiable situation. You can have that personal experience when you pour fuel on a fire. The fire grows larger, although at first it seems that the fire has reduced for a very short time. But then it shoots up higher than before. This teaching of Bhagavad Gita, given by Lord Krishna, resembles latest psychological studies of consumer behavior. Let's turn to Professor Robert Layard from the London School of Economics. He says, one reason why happiness has not risen despite our high standard of living is that we get used to the higher standard of living. At first, extra comfort gives extra pleasure. Then we adapt to it and our pleasure returns to its former level. I'm proposing tonight that we get to the root of the problem by addressing this fire of desire has an expression of consciousness and the needs and wants of consciousness for legitimate connection, the ultimate connection to the supreme consciousness. Therefore, we say Krishna consciousness. In other words, instead of directing desires toward goals that are unfulfilling, the yoga texts describe they should be aimed at a satisfying end, the ultimate connection. I'll end now with a statement from the text Srimad Bhagavatam, which is considered to be the graduate study to Bhagavad Gita. Life's desires should never be directed toward sensual gratification. One should desire only a healthy life or self-preservation, since a human being is meant for inquiry about the supreme ultimate. Nothing else should be the goal of one's works. At the Rotman School of Business and Management, I indeed spoke about our working occupations as a vehicle for enlightenment, how to use the workplace as a means for connecting to the ultimate. Perhaps in future engagements, we can go more into that. Once again, I'd like to stress, this may seem impractical, but as Dr. Speth of Yale University has recently stated, now is the time to be so-called impractical, because everything else actually is impractical. And those who can think outside the box and are open to new or very old ways of doing things, they're actually the practical ones, because what we have considered practical for so many decades, he says, is not working. It won't make a difference in terms of how far down the road we are to environmental severity. Let's focus on more than just the maximization of shareholders' wealth. Let's have accountants value not simply the environment, which would be a great improvement, but also the needs of consciousness for enlightenment. Because indeed, self-realization, enlightenment, as we say, Krishna consciousness, is the actual self-interest of a human being, all living entities, the ecosphere itself. Thank you very much.